Good afternoon and welcome to the Cato Institute. My name is Mustafa Akyol. I'm a senior fellow here at the Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity, focusing on Islam, modernity, and public policy. And today we are, by the way, Ramadan Mubarak for all those who might be celebrating as well. We're in the holy month for the Muslim world. Today we are going to discuss the past, present, and future of freedom in the Middle East. It's a very easy topic, so it's not obviously, and it's a big topic. It's an important one because, as many international studies, including our Human Freedom Index that we publish at the Cato Institute in cooperation with the Fraser Institute of Canada, show, the Middle East is the least free part of the world. And why is that the case? And what are the policies to make things better? So we'll have a conversation about that. Now, why is the Middle East the least free part of the world? For some people in the West, especially, the answer is simple. It's a big, simple answer: Islam. Right? Islam is a religion that is illiberal by nature. They think then the Middle East is majority Muslim, so that must be the reason why it is not free compared to other places. However, there is also a big, simple flaw in this argument, and that is Islam has dominated the Middle East for 14 centuries, but the freedom problem, the freedom gap, is relatively recent. In the past few centuries, you would say, the Middle East has become less free than other parts of the globe. And in fact, until a few centuries ago, the Middle East was more free than other parts of the world, including Europe. That's why minorities, religious minorities persecuted in the Middle East, often escaped to the Middle East. That includes Jews, that includes Christian heretics. You know, they found more religious freedom in the Middle East. And this fact, I mean, has been acknowledged by the late great historian Bernard Lewis, who was not shy away from, who did not shy away from being critical of Islam. But he did grant that the medieval Islamic world offered vastly more freedom than any of its predecessors, its contemporaries, and most of its successors. Therefore, the freedom deficit we're speaking in the Middle East is a relatively new phenomenon. It's a modern phenomenon. That is one reason why some people have found the culprit in totally somewhere else, not in Islam, not in something in the region, but in the outside powers that have colonized, occupied, or manipulated the region for their own interests, but often to the detriment of the native peoples. And as an observer of this region, I think there is some truth in that, in the sense of the disastrous results of colonialism, and also because Western or Russian, you know, intrusions in this region have made Middle Eastern societies distrustful and defensive, which are not the political sentiments that are sensitive to liberalism. All societies, including Western ones, tend to be less liberal when they feel insecure. However, pointing to only outside problems also has the problem of neglecting the internal problems of this region, which has been identified and studied by the region's reformists in the late Ottoman Empire or the Arab world since the 19th century. So today, we will look into those internal problems that may have kept the Middle East less free than other places in the world. What could those problems be? And we are lucky to have Professor Timur Kuran, who just wrote this phenomenal book on this issue, Freedom's Delayed. I have my own copy here, which I underlined and read religiously. Professor Kuran is the professor of economics and political science and professor of Islamic studies at Duke University. His earlier books, The Long Divergence and Islam and Mammon, offered original perspectives on the history of modernization in the Middle East, as well as the challenges and the prospects offered by the Islamic tradition. And his new book is a tour de force, really, that scrutinizes the topic. And so we will hear from him first 30 minutes, and we are delighted to have him today for this discussion. Thank you for coming here, Timur, for this event. And after Dr. Timur, we will hear a commentary from Professor John Wall. He is a professor emeritus of Islamic history and past associate director of the Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. He has published over a dozen acclaimed monographs or edited books on the Muslim world, which I also read and learned a lot from. And he's truly a towering scholar of Islamic studies in the United States. So we are honored to host him today at Cato as well.
Thank you.
So, Timur, let's start with you. Please use the next 20, 30 minutes to explain why freedoms are delayed in the Middle East, but not necessarily denied, as I think you put it. Then we will continue with Dr. Wall's comments, my thoughts, and questions and answers. And before getting to that, I should say that feel free to ask questions online as well for our online audience using the hashtag Cato, Cato CEF through Twitter or YouTube on X, and we will try to answer online questions as well. So, Timur, thank you. Floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate this opportunity that the Cato Institute has given me, and I'm greatly honored to be on stage with two scholars I greatly admire and whom I've learned from. And thank you, Mustafa, for not only for critiquing the book extensively before it was published, that I made use of your comments. I hope I made good use of the comments, but also for setting the stage for my own summary of the book. Now, as Mustafa said, the Middle East is a politically troubled region. Autocratic governance is the norm. Minorities, ethnic, religious, ideological, face discrimination, in many cases persecution. There's high discontent in the region. This is partly for economic reasons, but repression of various forms is also a factor. Occasionally, the discontent boils over and we see protests. So in Iran, in September 2022, protests erupted and they lasted for several months. The regime had great difficulty putting down the protests. The spark was, you'll recall, the death of Mahsa Amini under torture. Her ostensible crime was showing her hair in public or appearing in public without a headscarf. 12 years earlier, we saw the Arab Spring, and there were major protests that started in Tunisia, and they spread to many other Arab countries. There's a difference between these two episodes. The Arab Spring toppled several dictators, but the Iranian theocracy has survived, at least until now. But there are also some commonalities. One is that these were both spontaneous eruptions. They were not started by organizations that had a long history. In the case of the Arab Spring, the Muslim Brotherhood is the exception that proves the point. It stayed on the sidelines until it was clear that Mubarak was going. There were some organizations that were formed during the Arab Spring, many of them through social media. They proved to be ephemeral. Many of them disbanded after the Arab Spring ended and a new winter began in Egypt. In Iran, observers around the world, including myself, we waited in vain for some leader to emerge to give direction to the protests, to coordinate the protests, It did not happen. Contrast this with the Me Too movement in the United States, Black Lives Matter, or the pro-choice movement, pro-life movement. In each of these cases, there are organizations behind them, or when they start, organizations that have been around for decades start playing an important role. Now, the second commonality between these two episodes is that in each case, the masses cried out for greater freedoms. In Iran, the demand that caught most attention is the freedom to decide whether to wear a headscarf. Even conservatives, I might point out, Iranian conservatives, very pious Iranians, joined in the protests. There were protests in the most conservative cities of Iran. They were not necessarily anti-hijab. The vast majority just wanted women to have the freedom to decide whether to wear a headscarf out of conviction, or whether not to wear one. But even though the media focused on the opposition to mandatory hijab, because that's there were wonderful pictures and videos that came out of women holding a scarf in front of the morality police and so on. Actually, if you look at, if you read detailed analyses, they were, the demands were broader. They were opposed to, many of the demonstrators were opposed to religious repression generally. They were opposed to political repression as well. The Arab Spring was similar, though the emphasis was on more political freedoms. Now, before developing the argument in the book, let me emphasize something that Mustafa already mentioned. This is a glass half full, half empty argument. I reached the conclusion that there is no quick fix to the illiberalism of the Middle East, but there's a great deal of hope for the long run. And that's, as Mustafa said, why the book is called Freedoms Delayed and not Freedoms Denied. Now, I've used the term Middle East. It's an elastic concept. I mean here 24 countries, 22 countries of the Arab League, plus Iran and Turkey. The Middle East, as I'm defining it, is a subset of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is whose members formed, according to one definition, the Muslim world. Now, there's an analytic reason for focusing on the Middle East within the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC. The Middle East stands out as substantially more repressive on practically every dimension of freedom. The Middle East is, and this is not coincidental, the part of the Muslim world that has had the highest exposure to Islamic law. That the Middle East is the most repressive region of the world is evident in a wide variety of indices prepared by various organizations. I'll just give you a few: the Civil Liberties Index of Freedom House, the Rule of Law Index of the World Bank, various religious freedom indices of Pew, Freedom of the Press indices of prepared by various organizations, Gallup, and according to all of these indices, the Middle East turns out to be substantially more repressive than the OIC, which in turn is more repressive than the world as a whole. Gallup asked just a few years ago people around the world, or samples around the world, whether they would emigrate immediately if they could. For the Middle East, the figure was 27%. People would immediately leave and emigrate permanently. For the OIC as a whole, it was 23%. The average is about 16% for the world. Global survey companies can't ask whatever they please in every country. For the World Value Survey, as with other survey companies, obstacles are greater or highest in the Middle East. In the Middle East, the 41% of the World Value Survey, members of the World Value Survey from the Middle East, could not be asked the question whether they believe in God. The figure for the OIC as a whole, including the Middle East, is 18%. For the World Value Survey's global sample, the figure is 3%. This gives you a sense of how repressive the Middle East is. Now, how does the book investigate why the Middle East is so repressive today? Well, unfortunately, the indices that I've mentioned and many others that are given in the book are available at best as far back as World War II. We can't go back hundreds of years. If we could, we would see probably, as Mustafa just pointed out, the Middle East was up to a certain point, did not stand out as particularly repressive, might have been less repressive at certain times than Europe, and then started becoming repressive. When the changes occurred would give us a sense of where to look. Unfortunately, our indices don't go back that far. So here's how we can begin. Remember that with the Arab Spring and the Iranian Mahsa Amini protests, one reason for their failure was weak organizational capacity outside the state. Now, where might this have come from? And what sectors of the social system in the Middle East might have generated? Well, let me start with private commerce and finance. For a millennium, private commerce and finance was carried out in the Middle East by atomistic, ephemeral, and very simple organizations. Now, in one of the earlier books that Mustafa mentioned, The Long Divergence, I discuss why this contributed, the atomism, the smallness of enterprises that were established according to Islamic law, caused economic underdevelopment by the 18th and 19th century. What's relevant here is the political consequences. Ephemeral organizations don't form business organizations. They're not going to be around for very long. Most of these enterprises were established, profit-making enterprises were established for 3, 4, 5 months, and then they could be reconstituted, but it was under a different contract. So they couldn't, ephemeral enterprises can't make credible long-term promises. That's just one of the reasons why you're not going to get business or organizations. Well, without business organizations, merchants and financiers can't acquire the bargaining capacity to exercise power over the state. They can't start establishing checks and balances or contributing to the development of political checks and balances. So the bottom line is that the business sector, the private business sector in the Middle East, did not contribute to the development of what we now call civil society. And it wasn't until the second half of the 19th century that indigenous Middle Easterners were able to form large, durable, that was long-living enterprises that could, independent entities or jointly with others through business organizations, exert political power. Now, another reason why private organizational capacity was traditionally low in the Middle East has to do with an institution through which public services were provided. I have in mind charitable NGOs or non-governmental organizations that were known as waqfs. Now, what is a waqf? It is an Islamic trust or a trust established under Islamic law. A founder, always an individual, a group could not establish a waqf, it was an individual who endowed private property in perpetuity and irrevocably to provide services that were designated in a deed that was filed in court. The assets of any waqf were considered sacred, regardless of what these services were, and they did not have to be religious services. They could be many other things. Because the assets were considered sacred, waqf assets were secure, and massive resources flowed into waqfs as people in an environment where private property was insecure sought to secure their properties. I should mention here that when you set up a waqf to provide social services that others would benefit from, you could also provide services that would benefit yourself and your family. So this was one of the great incentives to established waqfs. So anything that was legitimate under Islamic law could be serviced through a waqf, could be financed through a waqf. So mosques, schools, water fountains, hospitals, soup kitchens, inns for merchants on the Silk Road, one camel day apart in terms of distance, you find inns for merchants. The vast majority were established as waqfs. Now, the waqf is the Islamic institutional counterpart of the corporation in the West. Now, what's the difference? The corporation is a self-governing organization, whereas a trust or its Islamic counterpart, the waqf, was an organization that was governed according to a deed that was, as I said, irrevocable and in principle unchangeable. And this lasted for about a millennium. So mosques were established as waqfs. Churches were established as corporations, at least after the 11th century or so. In the great cities of the Middle East, social services were provided by waqfs in a decentralized manner. In Europe, thousands of cities got chartered and they provided services through their local governments. Madrasas were established, these are Islamic institutions of higher learning. They were established as waqfs. Universities were established as corporations. Now, why is this very significant? In the case of the Middle East, vast resources flowed into waqf. Depending on where you look, by the 19th century, between 40% and 70% of all assets not owned by the state are, you find that they're in waqfs. You expect that entities that control such vast wealth would become powerful players. But actually, the Middle East's waqfs were politically powerless. Unlike the corporations in Europe that gained the guilds, the universities, the churches that gained a lot of political power, and all gained seats at the political bargaining table. This was not the case for waqfs. They did not get, now among the reasons is that they had no legal standing. They could not be represented as an organization in court. They were not allowed to participate in politics. The constituents of waqfs, the people who would benefit from a soup kitchen or who would benefit from a hospital, had no say in how the resources were used. They could not petition to have an official who was not doing his or her job removed. The caretakers of the waqfs and other officials of the waqfs were not accountable to their constituents. They did not have to share any information about the finances of the waqf, how they were running it. And waqfs could not form coalitions, they could not merge, so these resources could not be pooled together. In fact, in the history of the Middle East, we see practically no mergers of waqfs over a millennium. So one of the consequences of these rules is that waqfs did not contribute to the establishment of checks and balances. They also did not develop any ideologies. I'm particularly interested here in liberal ideologies. The corporations that took part in politics in Europe played roles in developing various ideologies that laid the foundation for the liberal societies that emerged in the modern era. This did not happen with waqfs. Now, to sum up thus far, two types of NGOs, profit-making enterprises and charitable waqfs, or partially charitable waqfs, created a vicious circle of illiberalism. They didn't create checks and balances, which allowed arbitrary rule to continue, arbitrary rule by the sultans to continue, and facing little opposition from below or little resistance from below, sultans did not create checks and balances themselves until very late in the game, late in the 19th century, when the Middle East was facing an existential threat from the West. Now, civil society in the Middle East started developing in the late 19th century from a very low base. Now, and I should point out that the that in the case of the West, as it was liberalizing through various struggles between between NGOs and the state, and as they were developing ideologies that would support their causes, their resistance to the state, the checks and balances they were trying to impose, they one of the things that that happened is that they started promoting religious liberalization. Now, this brings us to a big hindrance, another big hindrance that played a big role in the past in preventing liberalization, and that is an obstacle today as well. I have in mind apostasy and blasphemy laws. Now, one of the consequences of the of apostasy and blasphemy rules is that interpretations of Islam have not been liberalized, or at least have not been liberalized widely. I'll come back to this. Another is that these rules have blocked liberal schisms within Islam. Now, a schism is a formal separation of a movement, in this case, a religion, into entities that have their own officials, their own doctrines, their own rituals, that have their own property. Has Islam seen schisms? Yes, if we go back to early in the religion in 661, there was the schism that split Islam into Sunni Islam and Shi'i Islam. More recent schisms that have been in the news include the emergence of ISIS. Just about a decade ago, it demanded a puritanical interpretation, much more puritanical interpretation of Islam relative to other interpretations that were dominant in Syria, Iraq, and other parts of the Muslim world. There have been schisms, of course, in other religions as well. The Protestant Reformation is one in Eastern Europe, and it generated many liberal schisms, or Protestantism itself. Within Protestantism, there have been many schisms, including liberal schisms. In Judaism, in Eastern Europe, in the 19th century, there was there were two schisms that created Orthodox Judaism on the one hand, a stricter form of Judaism, and a more liberal form of Judaism, Reform Judaism. Now, why is it the case that in Islam there has been no liberal schism, at least no major liberal schism? Well, there certainly have been liberal manifestos. There have been many books that are based on primary sources, on the Quran and Islamic precedents, Islamic traditions, that use these to develop a liberal interpretation of Islam. Mustafa Akyol is one of these interpreters, reinterpreters, who has written some very very fine books. But I would point out that writers like Mustafa Akyol and others like Abdullahi An-Naim or Sorush of Iran, even though their works have been translated into many languages and they have followers among intellectuals, they have not generated, their works have not generated even collectively, a movement for a liberal form of Islam on a scale of, say, the Muslim Brotherhood or ISIS in terms of the in terms of its impact, its global reach. And there's been no Protestant Reformation in Islam, nothing analogous to Reform Judaism as well. Now, it's not obvious why, because there have been anti-clerical movements or anti-ulama movements in the Middle East. There have been times when the powers of clerics have been diminished dramatically. The boldest movement was, of course, the secularization movement in Turkey in the 1920s, but there have been others. The Pahlavis were in Iran were secularizers, and the first Pahlavi, especially, was a radical secularizer who emulated Ataturk. In Tunisia, there's Bourguiba, who again tried to secularize Tunisia from above. Now, did they try to reinterpret Islam? No. They could have, they might have tried to liberalize exits from Islam. They might have developed a liberal version of Islam. They didn't do that. What they did was, instead, they repressed Islam. They drove it out of the public square. And their reasoning was that that religion would diminish over time. If they could just repress it, it would, with economic development, people would become less religious anyway, and then the issue would become moot. So they were these secularizers, including Ataturk and his followers in Turkey. They were modernization theorists before modernization theory became quite popular in the United States. Is it that there's a lack of demand in the Middle East for liberalization? No, there's a huge demand for liberalization on various fronts, on gender matters, on family matters. We saw this most recently in the Iranian protests. There's a demand for liberalizing various rituals. Since we're in Ramadan, I might as well mention fasting. There are, in the Middle East, in many places, during Ramadan, restaurants close either through government decree or because of social pressures. Yet there are a substantial share of Muslims in almost all across the Middle East do not fast, and they have various reasons for not wanting to fast or not fasting every day, and they would like the interpretation of this ritual, this Islamic requirement, to be relaxed, for people to have more freedom. There's a huge demand for, in many countries, for depoliticizing Islam, keeping governments from, keeping the state from using Islam for its own political ends. So despite this demand, widespread demand, and in spite of the many contributions, very fine contributions, that give us liberal interpretations of Islam, there is no sustained movement for liberal Islam. There is no organization that is offering an alternative to the existing variants, with its own command structure, with its own organization, and so on. Now, why this contrast? Why do we see in Islam many puritanical schisms, or schisms that call for demand a stricter interpretation of Islam, but no liberal schisms? Well, I'd like to point to two asymmetries. Remember, private organizational capital is weak in the Middle East. Liberals have to start from scratch. And these skills of developing civic organizations are not very advanced in the region. So this is one factor. The liberals are already in command of mosques. They already control existing religious structures, including educational institutions and so on. So this is one asymmetry. Second asymmetry is that liberals, by virtue of the fact that they are liberals, are not willing to coerce. And they're afraid of being accused of apostasy and blasphemy if they do put forward a liberal alternative. Their opponents, illiberals, are quite willing to use coercion, and they will, when they feel the need, accuse their opponents of apostasy and or blasphemy. So these factors are delaying liberalization in the Middle East. In this case, it's religious liberalization, but that is tied to other forms of liberalization as well. I should point out that there's no absolute barrier to voiding the apostasy or blasphemy restrictions in all of the liberal readings of the Quran, including those of Mustafa Akyol. There are various readings of the various readings of the Quran, which I find very convincing, that refute the notion that these rules, apostasy and blasphemy rules, can be based on the Quran. There are also many precedents for reinterpreting Islam massively. I mentioned the corporation that was lacking in the Middle East. The Middle East alternative was the Waqf. The corporation has legal personhood, which is incompatible with Islamic law, with traditional Islamic law that recognizes only the individuals as having legal authority. In the 1900s, beginning with Turkey and Egypt, countries of the region instituted laws of corporation, and there was hardly any resistance from clerics. Let me give you another example. So this was a huge reform that has had major implications. I'll give you another example. One of the five pillars of Islam is zakat, which involves the duty to pay an Islamic tax once a year. Zakat was Islam's original tax system. Even though this became a pillar of the religion early on, it was essentially abandoned, and it became a minor ritual in the first century of Islam. That's another major change that occurred. Now, let me wrap up by returning to a key theme, which is that the glass is half full and half empty. What is the source of my optimism? Well, the Waqf, that was a huge barrier to the development of civil society, is defunct. There are organizations called Waqfs in the Middle East today, or in many countries of the Middle East, but they are, it's only the name that is similar. They're actually charitable corporations. The Islamic Waqf of the type that was prominent before the 20th century is hardly exists anywhere. So, and it's also possible to establish now charitable corporations, including very large charitable corporations, and it's possible to organize, finance and set up big business enterprises. Okay, so this again, so these the problem of scale in the case of business and finance, it was a problem in the until the 20th century, is no longer a problem today. NGOs are developing. Civicus is an organization that tracks the development of civil society all across the world. One, and with regard to the Middle East, it shows a slow but steady development of civil society in many parts of the world. So that's another reason for optimism. People who participate in civic organizations develop skills which are useful for liberalization of various kinds, including liberalizing Islam. So sustained liberalization is more likely today than it was a century ago. Are the problems, gone away? No. Are the obstacles, ended? No, because civil society, as I said, started developing from a low base, and the Middle East has, in a little more than a century, has made advances that took Europe a whole millennium to make, and the process is not yet complete. Thank you.
Well, Timur, thank you. I mean, you covered so many topics in such a short time, and I took my notes, you know, to when you were writing, and thank you for the reference to my work as well. So I'll share my own thoughts as well, of course, but we will go to Professor John Wall. Professor Wall, please, in about 10 minutes, share your thoughts about some of the arguments that Professor Kuran just shared here, and what do you think about the future?
Well, let me first make sure that I can remember what 10 minutes is. I'll get myself here. Sorry about this.
I'll warn you if there's necessary. But
well, you know, I'll just put this down here. Thank you for a very kind introduction. And I have this feeling here in D.C. maybe today. I know there's a testimony by Robert Herr talking about our president and his memory. I should confess that I'm 5 years older than our President Biden is. And so I will appeal to you to take Herd's advice and look at me as maybe a sympathetic and well-meaning elderly man with maybe a poor memory, but at least sympathetic and well-meaning as we talk about these really crucial issues. I've got two general things that I just want to touch on because you raised so many in the book, but two things that I think we need to think about as we look at the kind of argument that you've been doing, and that is the terminology itself that we use. As you start with the Middle East and you define that, the terminology that we use very often doesn't quite fit the realities that we are describing, because the terminology comes from old men like me, and the reality is created by young men like you, right?
Thank you.
One really important term that we all use is religion. And as we look at the subject matter that we're talking about now today, as we look at that subject matter, we'll all say, we're talking about religion. Now, of course, surprise, you have a historian of religion sitting next to a political scientist economist. And what is the historian of religion going to say? Well, that economics is all nice and the politics is all good, but we really need to look at religion as well as we get in. Now, one of the advantages of being an old man is that you do have memories, sometimes memories of real things and sometimes memories that sort of appear. But I recall, especially these days with discussions like yours, Timur, I recall when I was a graduate student, I was a graduate student looking at a dissertation that I was writing on Sufi brotherhoods. Now, this was in 1960s. A month and a half before my oral comprehensive exams, my doctoral comprehensive exams, the Imam of Yemen was overthrown by an idealistic, quote, idealistic military dictator, Abdullah Salal, in Yemen. And I had, as I was going for job interviews, I had the interesting experience of people saying, well, now the really important things in the Middle East are these idealistic military officers, the really important things are the leftist radicals, really important things are the communists. Why are you writing about religion? Because at that point, for example, in 1968, one of the leading sociologists of religion, Peter Berger, gave a talk in which he said, now this is 1968, by the 21st century, religious believers are likely to be found only in small sects, huddled together to resist a worldwide secular culture. Now, if I'd have said what my colleague Timur is saying now, 60 years ago, they would have said, that's really off base. We all know that by the second decade of the 21st century, surely the believers are all just going to be little sects. They'll get your schisms. They'll all be little sects off. And the real power is going to rest with the leftists and the nationalists and so on. But the same guy who said that in 68, in 1998, edited a book called The Desecularization of the World. And in 30 years after he had said, all of the believers are going to be off in little sects off in the boondocks. In 98, he said, the assumption that we live in a secularized world is false. The world today is as furiously religious as it ever was, and in some places more so than ever. This means that the whole body of literature by historians and sociologists of religion, loosely labeled secularization theory, is mistaken. Now, we're stuck with this idea that religions are something. We talk about, if you want to study, if you're an undergraduate and you want to study some sort of religious experience, what you do is you take a world religions course. Nowadays, scholars are saying that the whole concept of world religions itself is an anachronism, that world religions as separate boxes living off with each other, and then they have a clash of civilizations or they have a clash of religions and so on, that there is too much interaction and too much blending together of what it is that we're looking at for us to view Islam as something totally separate or Christianity as something totally separate. Your optimism sounds to me, a liberal optimism shows that the boundaries between world religions and that the boundaries between civilizations are not rigid and fixed, but the boundaries are porous, so that the good things that will come, that the optimism that you see, I hear, is something that makes it possible for liberals. Maybe they're Muslim, maybe they're Christian, maybe they're agnostic, maybe they're atheist, but the boundaries between the boxes that we label religions are very porous. And that this creates then the kind of situation that you talk about, that in 2022 in Iran there were protests. You had the Arab Spring in 2010, 2011, 2012. And you're saying, no organization. How can you do anything with no organization? And yet things got done. And I think that we need to sort of look now at what it is that we're talking about and look at the importance of now then the second thing. Point one then. When we think about religion, let us remember that religion is a porous bounded thing as well as a strictly defined thing. We have two different meanings. Most people use religion in two different ways when they're doing analysis. One is religion as this separate box. You have, if you're studying religion, you have Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and so on. You have this list. But for a while, I taught a course called Religion in World History. And in the first session of that course, the starting question would be, what would you think the course would be if the title of the course was not Religion in World History, but Religions, plural, in World History? Would those be the same courses or would they be different? And religion is the experience of humans as opposed to how that experience gets defined in something specifically called a religion. So that I think we might want to try, I would add to your questions, how is it that this thing that was scheduled to disappear in 1968 when I was a graduate student suddenly has made all of those things disappear? Well, part of it is the changing nature of something that is very, I think it's very important that you're really emphasizing, and that is the importance of what gets called civil society. And as we look at civil society today, are there mechanisms that give some kind of strength and power? And I would suggest that people like me, people like us, we get very interested in the intellectual dimensions, the ideological dimensions, the sociological dimensions. And it becomes important for us to look at the religious and economic dimensions together as we're looking at them in civil society. Now, civil society, there is always civil society. Civil society is the non-state areas of human life. We have the question then of should one separate religion from politics? Should one separate from church and state? And the question that I would ask is separation of religion and politics the same thing as separation of church and state? And I would argue, no, not all religion takes place in the church, and not all politics takes place in the state. And as we look at today's world, I think that we have to begin to accept the fact that there is a new civil society that we are living in. I enjoy, again, if you're a grandpa or something like that, you can enjoy the civil society in which your grandchildren and great-grandchildren live. And it's amazing what I enjoy being told how to use my computer by my 11-year-old grandson. You know, that works. But in that sort of looking, what are the mechanisms? There may be non-organizational mechanisms that can tell us what's going on in the civil society. And I like, there's a book called Heavy Metal Islam, Rock, Resistance, and the Struggle for the Soul of Islam by Mark Levine. In the middle of that book, as he's introducing his argument, he says, to understand the peoples, cultures, and politics of the Muslim world today, especially the young people who are the majority of the citizens in that region, we need to follow the musicians and their fans as much as the mullahs and their followers. And I would suggest, for example, one of the interesting issues in the hijab, we are used to the argument of should people be forced to wear the hijab or not? Should people be forced to take off the hijab or not? And it becomes that kind of a good old-fashioned political issue. But if we take this kind of comment by Levine, that if we want to find out, you know, what the majority of the people in our world are talking about, we need to look at musicians as well as their fans. And just to take the issue of the hijab, Google the phrase hip-hop hijabis. Google the phrase hip-hop hijabis. And there the argument is, should young women wear a hijab while they're singing hip-hop, while they're doing hip-hop, while they are doing, and as one looks at then this new world, if you say, what's this, a hip-hop hijabi? I thought that kind of music was made illegal and that sort of thing by our ulama from the old days. But as we look, I have this little file. If you take a file on hip-hop and religion, make a file on hip-hop and religion, I've got here something, the Houthis in Yemen. Lyric of Houthis propaganda. Death to America and hostile Zion. But here, how do they present it? They're singing it in hip-hop kind of language. As we look at the...
It's going on in all different ways.
What?
It's going on in all different ways. I
mean, that's right. Yeah. There was an article last November in the New York Times trying to take Arabic hip-hop across the globe. Now, what does it mean? What does it do to our analysis? What does it do to my analysis of old Sufi tariqas, of yours, of Waqf, if we're saying that that one of the important things that we have to look at is the popular modes of expression? And do these provide mechanisms for expressing the thing without the kind of corporation that you're calling for? And I would suggest one might look at least three different areas of the emerging global civil society, just quickly. The one is do the hip-hop. There's a very good book on global Muslim hip-hop by Abdul Karim Nasser from Southeast Asia. Or Suad Abdul Khabir, who has worked on hip-hop and Muslim identity, that we can look at hip-hop as the mechanism that is non-corporate but still provides a kind of connection. Because we now don't, maybe we don't have to have the corporation, maybe the social media are what we need as well. Or the kind of thing of that has been written about by somebody by the name of Sean Foley, which is on the new art movement in Saudi Arabia, where you have a a community, not a corporation, but a community of artists and cultural people who are expressing the meaningful things of their liberalism, their conservatism in art and in music. And Sean has a whole chapter on the stand-up comedian, and it's the Muslim stand-up comedian. Now, I'll just stop here at this point, but say, as we think about the important issues that you're raising, let's not just think about the ulama, let's not just think about the intellectuals, even old good friends like Fazlur Rahman, but let's also think about what is the message that we're getting and what is the message that's being delivered by Muslim hip-hop, by Muslim art, by Muslim music, and so on. So.
Yeah, heavy metal as well. Which thank you so much. Thank you so much. This was a great addition, you know, to the conversation. thanks to you both, really. And now, let me add a few thoughts on directly to some of Timur's arguments in the book. And Timur, I think you make a point rightly so about the lack of liberal Sikhisms, but also combined with Dr. Vole's analysis, I think what we have today in the Islamic world is a really big spectrum. And you mentioned ISIS. I mean, that is the far, far end of the dark side of the spectrum that even other jihadists find too radical and crazy. And then jihadists themselves are the extreme. And then you come to conservatives of different stripes. And even some of those conservatives are taking towards what we call towards a more progressive future or liberal future. I mean, you mentioned, for example, Nahdlatul Ulema in the book, which is important. In that, Indonesia's greatest Islamist book. So there might be people like myself or others who say, okay, let's fully embrace classical liberal values and they're compatible with Islam. That might be on the one end. But then there are others, conservatives, not maybe exactly there, but not too far. It's just a whole big spectrum. And I think it's changing through a spectrum shift. Like, for example, the issue of apostasy was... People thought that apostasy in Islam should be killed. But now, even among conservatives, they would say, oh, the medieval ban on apostasy was about rebellion against the state. Maybe freedom of conscience today does not, you know, is not the same thing. So there's some subtle change, I think. And the hip-hop culture might be helping that, of course. But will it become a Sikhism, clearly, like Reform Judaism? That's an interesting question. And I think Reform Judaism is the right analogy here rather than Protestantism. It may happen. We might see that in the... with all the hip-hop ladies and others, maybe heavy metal youngsters. One more thing, I liked your emphasis on a part of the problem in the Middle East, which is seculars have been oppressive too, and they have not helped, right? The Iranian Shah, Turkey's Kemalist secularism, the Arab dictators, Nasser's and Saddam's and Bashar Assad's of the world, they brought in something called modern and secular and new, but they were brutally oppressive, often on religion itself. So Muslims never experienced a kind of Jeffersonian limited government, classical liberal system. Turkey sometimes came close to it, and I think that's one reason Turkey did better than others, especially in the second half of the 20th century under Turgut Özal and other leaders. But I think that's an important point, that it's not just about religion versus secularism, it's about freedom for everyone, right, including secular and religious segments of society. And the you're right on apostasy and blasphemy laws in Islam being used as a thought stopper or silencer of, you know, not just critics of Islam, but reformists within. And there have been people who just have new approach to Islamic law or theology and who've been targeted by these laws. That's a major issue, you're right. But there's some change about that, so I would like to emphasize that. Finally, the part of your book I love most is where you say Islamism's missed opportunities for liberalism. So you show the missed opportunities, which means there are sources there that we can tap into. People discuss about the constitution of Medina, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, you know, signed with the tribes in Medina when he went there. Oh, that's two Jews, their religion, two Muslims, their religion. That's a pluralistic model. Sometimes people aspire to that as opposed to supremacism. Or you mentioned how zakat could be a limited government idea instead of the other interpretations of it that developed. So those missed opportunities, I think, are important. Christianity uses missed opportunities ultimately to come to liberalism after 1,000 years of religious persecution and violence. I mean, for example,
I think one of the opportunities was render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, what is God's, God's. That was not seen as a basis for secular governance for 1,000 years, but in the Enlightenment era, some Christians began to see it like that. And Muslims are like that, discovering the roots there, no compulsion in religion, all these values in the Quran. And you emphasize that, certainly, in the book. And I think that's why being critical of the real problems and seeing the future ahead is important. And the social dynamic that Dr. Wall is like, yeah, is very important. I think that there's a whole internet generation and hip-hop generation, all that, and that will things to new places that we don't even maybe see today. That's quite right. Now, thank you both. And now we have our time for questions. We have our online audience already sharing some questions. I'll come to that. Let me correct myself. The right hashtag is CatoFP. Not Cato, the other one, but CatoFP. But we have already an audience here, and I see a hand right there. Please, sir. The floor is yours.
Yes, I'm hoping you could add some intellectual clarity to one of the most prominent topics in this field that has come up in this discussion repeatedly, and I find personally, with no expertise, quite confusing. I've had an opportunity to travel widely in my career and have noticed that both the customs and the laws of dress codes vary from country to country, culture to culture, place to place within countries, and time to time. I just randomly would note that in the United States, it was illegal, a crime, for a man to go to the beach without a shirt on up until the 1930s. Every country I can think of has dress codes that are criminally enforced, and you could just use your imagination to see that. In my travels, it never occurred to me to either connect dress codes to religion or to liberalism or illiberalism. If you take the Enlightenment standards, it's speech and voting and stuff like that. It's not sort of what you have to dress or not have to dress. But in the last few decades, we've seen the emergence of dress requirements as being intimately connected with liberalism and illiberalism. But the French dress codes are different than the American dress codes. Anybody who's been to the beaches of the two countries can tell you that. And the American dress codes change from, the criminal dress codes change from time to time. And what you can wear at the beach is not what you could wear at downtown. And so I'm just confused about this enormous prominence that's given to dress codes in France and in other places, and its connection with liberalism or illiberalism, or for that matter, religion. So if you could just add some intellectual clarity to this notion of criminally regulating dress codes, which seems to me to be a universal phenomenon in every country I could think of. So thank you.
Thank you. I'll let come to you. Yeah, sure.
I can certainly answer it.
Sure.
If you want. So dress codes are signaling devices. Through communities, ensure the commitment of people who are benefiting from their services, all the benefits they provide to their members. They ensure the commitment of their members by making them dress a certain way in public. This commits them to being a member of the group, even in situations where it's disadvantageous to be seen as a member of that particular group. So this is part of it. And you're absolutely right that in the case of Islam, there are what is considered the properly Islamic dress for men or for women, varies across space, and it has varied across time. It's just part of culture, and as identity politics changes, dress codes change, but they're not unchangeable elements of Islam.
Yeah, and I would also add that, I mean, of course, cultures vary, and that's only normal, and people have the right to live by their culture or as individuals. The question is, does government use coercion to impose those certain dress codes in a society where there's reaction against this, there's a resistance against this? And I think on that, U.S. is more liberal than France. France interferes in women's dress codes to take them, push them to take their headscarves off, which is wrong, if illiberal, if you ask me. And of course, in Islamic states like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, there's a pressure to force women to put their headscarves on. Of course, harsher than France in a more sweeping way. But these are illiberal attitudes. And the more limited the state is, the less coercive, you would call that system more liberal. But yeah, there are some universal values, I mean, that most societies accept against full nakedness and stuff like that. I think there's less reaction against those, so there's less problem. And I think the state's intrusion here is the issue. Otherwise, it doesn't make you one more liberal to wear less dress or less dress, but it's the state's role, I think. Would you agree, Dr. Rohn?
Right.
Okay, great. So, Deidre, please.
Yes. Here we go. I would suggest that we stop using enlightenment as the crucial word here. I think the L word is much more important. I think it's not the French enlightenment of reason, which can be extremely illiberal and was in the 18th century and still is. The other point is that what I don't see here Professor Curran's way of thinking is an emphasis on ideas. And I see that much more in Professor Moll. Is it institutions that are the problem, or is it thought? Now, they're connected, but I wonder.
Timur, what would you think about that?
The emphasis in the book is on institutions, and as the subtitles, as political legacies of Islamic law in the Middle East. That's the question I'm answering here, but I completely agree that ideas and institutions co-evolve, and in the book's narrative, of course, I do discuss ideas that legitimized particular institutions, and also the effect of institutions in the evolution of ideas. I contrast universities with madrasas, and the universities generated a lot of ideas that contributed to liberalization of many dimensions, including religious liberalization in Europe. You didn't get that kind of intellectual dynamism from the madrasas. So, yes, ideas are certainly there. It is, you're right, it's not the focus here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go quickly because there are many questions online too, and we have little time. Radwan, you had a question as well? Please.
Thank you for your presentation. I think one word that is missing is the word ijtihad, which means reinterpreting the laws. My understanding of Islamic history is that the first nine centuries, were actually very advanced civilization was built in terms of even economy and technology and science and religion and liberal, you know, minorities, you know, and all that. And it's only in the last 3 centuries or 4 centuries that Islamic law has become fixed. When the door of ijtihad was closed, at least in the Sunni part of the Muslim world, and we had to, and the Islamic law was not being adapted anymore, was not being modernized anymore. In the last 3 or 4 centuries, the decline, what's called the decline of Muslim civilization. So the Muslim civilization had its golden centuries for, you know, 7 or 8 centuries. And so the problem is not Islamic law itself, it's what kind of Islamic law, and is it being modernized, is it being adapted to new tools or new discoveries or new methods, and certainly it wasn't, but now people are pushing for that to be reopened in order to modernize Islamic law and benefit from, you know, the new tools and the new ideas.
Would you agree to that?
Yes. Thank you for bringing up those points. Yes, Islam was very dynamic in its early centuries. In fact, the Waqf is a good example. It's not mentioned in the Quran. There's no evidence of the Waqf existing in the first century of Islam. And it was borrowed from the Romans and Persians and improved upon. The trusts, the Roman and Persian trusts, were used primarily to finance religious organizations, temples, churches. When the concept of the trust was brought into Islamic law, it was a big innovation. It was applied not just to the financing of religious structures, in this case it would be mosque and Quran schools, but anything legitimate under Islamic law. That was a huge innovation, and the Waqf played a big role for many centuries in the economic development of the region. It was a magnificent institution that enabled social services to be provided in a decentralized manner, taking into account the needs of local communities. It's libertarians' dream. But eventually, this rigidity that wasn't a big problem at a time when technology were changing very slowly, suddenly became a big problem in the 17th and 18th, 19th centuries when technology started changing very rapidly. But thank you for bringing up this, this point.
And confiscating them was the modern solution, which actually made the states Leviathan, so which was not the right solution. I think that's a very important point. You emphasized, Timur, and I think anybody who studies Islamic law, many of the structures we are criticizing in Islam or Islamic law today had a perfect rationale 1,000 years ago. Like, it was not a problem then. It was actually progressive in many ways. The problem is not understanding social change, a critique brought by Fazlur Rahman, for example, which you mentioned today. Like, social change requires adaptations, and there is a lack of adaptation to that, I think, in both jurisprudence and institutionally, and I think institutionally, Timur highlights that.
And I would just add that one of the big intellectual challenges is understanding why that dynamism was lacking in certain areas, why certain institutions interacted in such a way as to generate an equilibrium that was resistant, that prevented innovation. And that is something that I do. This book is a sequel to The Long Divergence, which looks at the economic underdevelopment. This is, you might say, the political sequel to it. And the way I frame these various puzzles is, why did particular changes not occur? Why did certain innovations not come from below?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. So let's go quickly. There is another question here, sir, gentlemen. Yeah.
From what I see from the title of the book, looks that the author intended to attach lack of freedom and everything to Islam and completely forget the political reason in the, at least in the since World War II or before that, to colonialism and to US and Israeli in the Middle East and their policy and imposing it on the people rather than having anything to do with Islam. How can you tell that today in US there is freedom that I believe that there is none? The reason is none, that me, you, and everybody here, even in the whole country, they have no power to do what the administrations are doing because the president are assigned already. You have to vote one of them. You have no choice. It's the same as you want to attach it to Islam. It's the same what's happening here. It's just this year. Look at it. Nobody could talk about any other candidate like Robert Kennedy Jr. or others, except talking about Biden or Trump, whether you want it or you doesn't want it. So please, when you talk about the issues of in the Middle East and actually in the whole world, is with the unfortunate power of the U.S. under control of Israel, I believe, is that all this problem for the Middle East with all enormous amount of the money from the oil, you see there are all, majority are poor. Why? All the money is here or is in Europe and by corruption, by corporations that you are very interested in, that those corporations are the ones that are imposing their idea, whether through this government or the other agencies I don't want to mention. And that what I wanted to make a comment, or you want to answer?
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. I mean, in the beginning, I mentioned that the Middle East has internal and external problems, and external problems include Western colonialism, Russian interventions, Western military interventions, wars. We mentioned those. Well, we just said today we are focusing, because of Timur's book, and on the internal issues. Of course, we can criticize Western foreign policy towards the region. We often do at Cato. I mean, so you're welcome to join those as well. Just today, Timur's book is about the internal reasons. And I, as a Muslim, as someone from the region, I'm a Turk and Muslim, and I believe we have problems coming from outside and outside powers, and I'm very critical of those. But we have problems within too, and I try to see both. Just our topic today is has been the problems, especially within, and that's why we discussed. But thank you for your perspective. And well, is America free? Well, I mean, at least you can say what you can say. Yes, I'm. Maybe we're not excited about the choices in the elections too, but that's anybody's political thought. But at least you can say your voice without fear, which is not the case everywhere in the world. Mohammed, please.
Can I just add one point? Because there were three points, and I'll just very briefly. Islam itself is not in the title. Islamic law is. Islamic law is a human construct, and it developed over several centuries and achieved its classical form and
under
between
empires,
the 9th and, and the 10th century. It's those institutions that I'm studying, not Islam per se. And I might point out also that I'm very troubled by the United States. I'm in the process of writing a book that is even more pessimistic about the future of the United States than the Middle East. But that's a different topic.
Let's have a panel on that too, inshallah. Yeah. Mohammed, please, you had a hand.
Well, thank you so much for an enriching discussion and talk. I have two quick questions. One about the pre-modern period. There were many times in which Sufi brotherhoods representing both ideological and political forces in different contexts that challenged the sultans and the central governments. Do you account for that in your analysis of the legacies from the pre-modern period? And looking ahead, I see in different contexts now, like I'm following the debates in Morocco about the new family law, different political parties are engaged in these debates, and they're representing also ideological varieties in society. When talking about, and then here we find it's hard to separate between a political party and a civil society organization. They're representing both. How do you see that looking forward, that how political parties would engage in these debates about Islamic law and political liberties? Thank you.
You want it?
So let me comment on the first. I do take into account the Sufis, and I spent quite a lot of time looking at the Sufis, perhaps not at their religion itself, certainly not to the satisfaction of scholars of religion. But I do observe that Sufi brotherhoods were tolerated as long as they were not political. The moment they became a political threat, they were decimated in the Ottoman Empire. Iran did the same thing, and there are examples from other parts of the region. And Professor Vohl might have additional insights.
That's right. I think, but they provide, and you suggest this in your conclusion, that Sufism provides also a basis for optimism of resources for organization and ideological development.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Our time is almost up. I just want to have at least one online question, and apologies for the online viewers whose question we couldn't get to. Bishar Al-Shabaab asks, is forced secularism through undemocratic means required for Middle Eastern countries to move on from Islamic law and Sharia, or will it happen through democratic reforms? What do you think, Timur?
So I don't see those as mutually inconsistent. I think forced secularism, if it means Kemalism or a variety of Kemalism, I think this is just another form of illiberalism. It drives religion underground, and it increases religiosity. And Turkey has found this out the hard way. As
it comes back with a vengeance.
This was the same case in Iran. I think a form of secularism that gives individuals the right to choose what they're going to believe, the right to convert into a religion, leave a religion, be openly atheist, openly agnostic. This is something that I think it would be good if it did, if states did pass laws that guaranteed it. But the laws themselves are not going to bring religious freedoms if social pressures are working against them. So
it's not an either-or question.
It's not an either-or. One needs also to educate, and intellectuals have a role to play. It's a big problem that cannot be solved just by passing laws. If that were the case, freedoms wouldn't be delayed. Yeah. There would be a quick fix, but the book argues that there isn't.
It's a big problem, but hip-hop will help, I believe, as Professor Wall said.
Yes, it can help.
Exactly, and all the social movements out there. Well, thank you so much to you both. This was a delightful conversation. Thanks for coming to us. Thanks to our audience for joining us.
Thank you very much for organizing this.
You're welcome. And